You're listening to Tech Talk Radio in your backyard and worldwide on the pod.
Every once in a while, a revolutionary product comes along that changes everything.
It's the first time that Apple have actually decided to tell people about something that they're developing.
High-speed broadband, let's just make sure that we can get it in Australia this year, not next.
The three main spamming countries are the United States, China and South Korea.
And I've got some residual powers.
Sounds like something out of Harry Potter.
Senator Coonan, the voice of reason.
There's a couple of systems on a gantry that's actually based on a military missile tracking system.
You put the date on ePray and you get a whole service.
How does it go?
IE7, you're having trouble installing it because you had a genuine copy of Windows that wouldn't validate properly. What did you have to do to get past that?
Built a new machine.
But how hard can it be?
No, it's not hard at all.
At the end of the day, the photography is all about the person's eye and what they see.
If you find something that's inappropriate about your child, you need to do something about it because it will not go away.
On air, on the internet and on the pod, you're listening to Tech Talk Radio.
Hello everybody and welcome to Tech Talk Radio. I'm your host Andrew McComb. As consumers of technology, or any commodity for that matter, we place a certain amount of trust in the hands of manufacturers or service providers. Technical specifications aside, we as consumers place a great deal of weight on the brand name behind whatever it is that we're buying. But at what price? Brand names are everything. Recently on Tech Talk Radio, we spoke of the great brands of 2008, of which Google, Microsoft and Apple were amongst the top 10 global brands. So do we assume that just because these guys are on top of the ladder, that they won't sell us a dodgy product? In today's cutthroat world of retailing, companies need to maintain good margins on products. When that margin is threatened by competitors and cheap imitation copies of products from, say, China and Asia, don't you think the marketing departments of said companies would do anything to improve the sales and hence the company's bottom line? Or what about just unscrupulous companies that put sales before customers? We're not immune from this sort of corporate mischief in Australia either. Recently, what was once a trusted and respected Australian IT company betrayed local consumers by saying that their service was everywhere you needed it, when, according to the ACCC, it wasn't. The Federal Court agreed with the ACCC and found that the company's claims were misleading. This week, the mail order computer company Dell was found guilty in an American court of false advertising and fraud. According to the court, the company engaged in abusive debt collection practices, misled consumers with financial terms for which they'd qualified, and failed to provide consumers with promised rebates. The case arose after hundreds of complaints about Dell and its financial arm, Dell Financial Services. As a result, Dell now faces the prospect of a huge damages claim. So what motivates the large corporate players to deceive and lie to consumers, the people that keep them in business? Is it the nature of just a few rotten apples in the marketing bunch? Are they just innocent mistakes by ill-informed individuals? Or are the company executives fully aware of their actions, knowing full well that they're stretching the truth? Take that into consideration when upgrading or buying your next gadget. After all, once a company blots its copybook, what's to say that they're not going to do it again?
This week on Tech Talk Radio,
we continue our chat with Rico Malvar from Microsoft Research in the United States. Adam turns his attention to the slow take-up of Blu-ray. Mr. Gates promises multi-touch Windows 7. And is it the end of an era for papered airline tickets? First up, here's the latest happenings from the Tech Talk Radio news desk with Graham Callaghan.
This is Tech Talk News.
This week on Tech Talk News, the ACCC accidentally discloses Google's criticism of eBay. Microsoft Vista is not a failure, says Steve Ballmer. The first domestic Blu-ray disc recorder hits Australian shores. An Adobe Flash Player exploit redirects victims to malware-infected servers. And a new game for the Nintendo DS helps smokers kick the habit. Welcome to Tech Talk News. The Australian Competition and Consumer Commission last week accidentally disclosed that Google is the anonymous source of a submission that is highly critical of eBay's PayPal exclusivity proposal. The 38-page submission is critical of eBay's plan, which Google has described as anti-competitive. A disgruntled eBay user linked the anonymous submission on the ACCC's website with Google after finding hidden metadata in the downloaded PDF document. Metadata is additional information usually contained in the contents of a file, and in this case disclosed that the original file name contained the words Submission by Google. The PDF was removed from the ACCC's website a few hours after the discovery, then returned later without the incriminating metadata. The submission was made by Google in response to eBay's application to grant it immunity from prosecution under the Trade Practices Act ahead of the PayPal exclusivity changes. The ACCC's response to eBay's request is being closely watched around the world, especially given that eBay Australia is being used as a guinea pig for the change to PayPal only. The plan is not popular with many eBay users because the auction company extracts a fee for use of the PayPal system in addition to auction fees. Steve Ballmer has lashed out at critics of Microsoft Vista at the D6 All Things Digital conference in San Diego last week. Microsoft heavyweights Bill Gates and Steve Ballmer answered many questions at the conference, with a defensive Ballmer saying that Vista is not a failure and evading questions about the failed merger between Microsoft and Yahoo. Microsoft also previewed Windows 7 at the conference, which CEO Bill Gates said is the beginning of an era of computing based on a new hierarchy of input systems. Mr. Gates demonstrated multi-touch technology as a fundamental part of the new operating system, similar to that already used in Apple's iPhone. The new Windows 7 operating system is expected to be released in late 2009. The first consumer Blu-ray disc player capable of recording free-to-air high-definition broadcasts will arrive in Australia next month. Panasonic's DMR BW500 is believed to be the first consumer Blu-ray disc recorder capable of recording 1080p digital high-definition television with removable media. Australia is also the first country outside of Japan to receive the technology, ahead of overseas markets including the United States and Europe. The new Panasonic machine will handle single-layer 25GB and dual-layer 50GB Blu-ray discs and comes with a 500GB hard drive and twin high-definition tuners. Other features include an HDMI 1.3 output, an inbuilt SD memory card slot, and a built-in USB port which lets users display photos or play MP3 files from any USB memory stick. The DMR BW500 will retail in Australia for $2,199. Panasonic's product announcement comes only 3 months after the so-called format war was declared officially over by consumer electronics experts, with HD DVD supporters being vanquished by Blu-ray manufacturers and their allies like Panasonic. Most regarded the format war as over when Toshiba made a statement in February this year saying it would no longer develop, manufacture or market HD DVD players and recorders. A reported exploit for Adobe's Flash Player has caused confusion among both IT experts and users. First reported as a zero-day exploit, the independent online security firm Security Focus later revised their claim when it was realized that the issue was almost identical to an earlier issue that has already been fixed in the very latest version of Flash. It has been reported, however, that many malicious websites are exploiting the flaw and that users are still vulnerable unless they are using the latest version. Adobe acknowledged the issue last week and encouraged users to upgrade their Flash players to version 9.0.124. Users should visit the Flash page at adobe.com to update their plugins. However, you must do this with each different web browser you use, even on the same computer. And finally, a new game for the Nintendo DS could help smokers to kick their nicotine addiction. The game, expected to go on sale in November, is being manufactured for the interactive touchscreen games console by Ubisoft. The so-called smoking cessation game asks players to enter a brief personal smoking history and choose a personal coach to guide them through the process of quitting. 15 mini-games then help players to dispel illusions about nicotine addiction, and players can track their progress in kicking the habit using the Path to Freedom meter. Ubisoft said in a press release that the player experiences a truly interactive engagement with the game, through which he or she learns that it can actually be enjoyable to quit smoking. Tech Talk News was compiled by Dr. Ron. I'm Graham Callaghan, and that's your tech update for this week.
Previously on Tech Talk Radio.
Mars got invaded from Earth today.
The exciting stuff about the way it's landed is it's done a soft landing using thrusters.
Let's talk about Microsoft. They've got into the cashback deal. Everyone's getting cashbacks these days.
In lieu of actually having better search technology.
Oh, well, cynical.
Spade is spade. Is that not a fair call?
If you're in the Northern Territory, consider yourself exceptionally lucky if you're hearing our podcast or listening to us at all.
Is it only Queenslanders that fall for this?
Well, yes, it is.
Is that what this report says?
Dr. Ron, you sent me a very interesting spam the other day.
That was bizarre, wasn't it?
I'm a male. I can only do one thing at a time.
I tend to do both at once.
If you're driving along, don't text while you're driving. It's bad for your health.
I've been taken out to dinner for my wedding anniversary, listening to some computer nerds talk on the radio.
Just because you've written a new post doesn't mean it's worth submitting to a social media site.
Ah, is it a scam?
Is it a scam?
Knowingly.
Computer stuff sucks a lot of power out of the wall.
Yeah.
What are you saying?
That's necessary. Yeah.
Vote one, global warming.
That's right.
Entertaining, informative, and independent. You're listening to Tech Talk Radio. The panel on Tech Talk Radio.
And here we are again, yet another evening, another day, wherever you might be listening to us, welcome. This is Tech Talk Radio. I'm Andrew McComb. Sitting across in front of me today, the three wise men. And we've got a visitor in the studio, but we'll talk about that later. Graham, good evening. How are you?
Good, Andrew. How are you?
Oh, look, can't complain. It's been so hectic today. Everything. We could do the whole show in what happened today in the technology world. I don't know whether you've been watching the emails. Dr. Ron.
I'm good, but I'm a bit sad because I left my favourite headphones at home.
So do you want us to talk louder?
I'm a grumpy Dr. Ron
grumpy
now.
Dr.
Yes,
Ron.
I'm kicking myself. How are you, Andrew?
And I have to sit next to him. That's no good at all.
Oh, dear, JD. Sorry, just move around the bench a bit and you'll be out of flack's way, I guess. So.
Very good.
Anyway, yeah, what a fantastic day it's been today. Well, everything that could possibly wanted to happen has happened, both professionally, both technologically, absolutely everything.
In a good way or a bad way?
Oh, I think so. Just the news in the IT news today has been phenomenal. We'll touch on that fairly shortly, but... On a professional scale, our television program started on the Nine Network today, which is alive and cooking. Go and have a look at that wherever you are around Australia.
That's exciting.
It was exciting. Inundated with emails already. It's unbelievable. So, yeah, it's just been really good. So what's been happening in the world today, boys? Should we start off with the hologram? Did you see the hologram?
I heard all about the hologram.
The holo projection.
Yeah, the hologram. Is it smoke and mirrors or what with Telstra?
You know,
yeah,
they way, like.
There's two schools of thought. There's the press release that you can actually see on the Telstra website, and there's some cynical writers. I love reading some of these tech writers out there. They're worse than us. They're very cynical.
Now, I saw a photograph which had like virtually a full size person standing on a stage,
like something out of Star Trek.
Same size as the real person beside it.
Yeah,
and. Yeah, I wasn't sure whether I was looking at something that had been photoshopped or whether it was a...
I think holograms, you have to be there. I don't think that quite worked too well on television or...
It still looked very convincing in the photograph.
It still looked a bit two-dimensional, though, even though they claim it was three-dimensional.
The news article that I read said Telstra has used the latest high-speed broadband technology to transmit an image of its chief technology officer in real time. Thought that's really good use of NextG, so the network will support holographic communication
now. Was that NextG, was it?
Oh, it's on the latest high-speed broadband technology, it must be. So I was quite impressed. I didn't realise that the pipes were that wide.
Yeah, it said in an Australian first, Telstra just recently showed a hologram to beam its chief technology officer, Dr. Hugh Bardlow, live into Adelaide from Melbourne to talk to a major function. He was there for 15 minutes, virtually. It's a bit like you, Dr. Ryan, virtually. Virtually. He was there. But nonetheless, it was interesting. There's links off the Telstra website sort of showing what technology that they used for it and all that sort of stuff. So
I'll be impressed when they can do it in two directions, because you didn't actually get to see the studio he was standing in and what was surrounding him at the time.
Yeah, why? Are you cynical? What do you think was there?
Well, you know, if you look at the Star Trek, Star Wars-esque holograms, you've got a person at each end. So, you know, Darth Vader appears on one hologram and the evil Lord appears on the other one. So this is all sort of one-ended, isn't it?
Yes. Well, did they interact? Did they chat and talk in real time, or was it staged?
I believe it was...
Did they take questions from the auditorium?
Yeah, look, I wasn't there, obviously, but reading the reports, it looks like he fielded questions from the audience, and there's some description about him having a plasma screen at his end so he could see what was going on in the auditorium. So.
Well, if you have a look on the website, you can see a link that goes to the Musen, if I'm pronouncing this correctly, the Musen Eyeliner, I think it is, system. And that's the organisation that actually did the projection. I don't know what they projected it onto, but yeah, it's quite interesting. Certainly generated a lot of interesting press around for the wrong reasons.
4 to 5 years away, the technology. Telstra reckon?
You reckon?
Yeah, for the consumer. That's great.
Absolutely. Anyway, correspondence. I've got some here. Steve Hudson sent us an email. Liked the show, been listening for a few years on the podcast because we poor sods in Sydney don't have a live broadcast. Well, what can I say? Yes, and he's come on with a couple of observations. For years, I've experimented with voice recognition on the PC, and it's always been a waste of time because the error rate. There has always been limited readback voices on Windows, and the default male voice has always sounded extremely fake and really annoying. I've always assumed that Microsoft designed it the way that a computer-generated voice. So there you go. And he's also given us some stuff about until now. Don't take this the wrong way, but after your interview with the Microsoft guy, Rico, last week, I now know whose voice they've used.
He thinks the male Microsoft voice is Rico.
Yeah, because Rico does sound very long-distant and all that, but I can assure you it was...
Might have just been our phone patch.
No, it wasn't too bad, actually, but yeah, no, that's how it sounded. So anyway, I got part two of Rico on this evening. Now, Dr. Ron, have you got some...
I've got lots.
Okay.
I've always got lots.
I know.
We've set up a new TikTok Radio Facebook group.
Man here with a Tech Talk. Have you?
Yes, that's exciting.
Man here with a Tech Talk Radio beanie cap on. I've never seen those before.
Where'd you get that cap?
Which shop did you get that at?
You can buy them. You can buy them on the internet now.
Is that what it is?
Yeah.
Okay.
Taking over the world we are. Now, yeah, you can go to Facebook and you can search for Tech Talk Radio in the groups and join our group. That would be exciting.
I need to sign up to Facebook.
But you don't have to if you don't want to, JD, but if you're already a user, then you can. We've got new forum users. Hello to Jeremy O in Melbourne, who joined last week. Also had some follow-up from... Remember our discussion with Michael Cremean about the Sony PlayStation 3?
Yes.
And we asked, did it have surround sound? The answer is yes, the PS3 can output HDMI video and audio.
Ah.
And optical audio. Hop onto YouTube and search for PS3 surround sound setup. I've got in my notes here. You can see what people are doing all over the world with their PS3s.
Hmm. I think it probably would also depend on the game supporting surround sound as well. So some games probably support it and others don't.
Good point. But the hardware does, apparently.
It probably supports it off your Blu-ray disc as well.
Well, I think that's where it's going to come into its own, isn't it? When people are using it as part of their home cinema setup.
Yeah.
We've got a question from a listener here. David says, hi, guys. Hi, David. Many times you correctly advise against clicking to open spam email. Does this mean that the email window preview pane should not be used? Well, that's a good question from David. So he's talking about preview panes that you have in...
It depends on what type of antivirus anti-spam thing you're running. But if you weren't running antivirus anti-spam, I'd be inclined not to run it in the preview mode for that very reason.
Because regardless whether you open the message, the program itself's opening the message, isn't it? And destroying it in the preview pane.
It's another one of those issues where ease of use and functionality pushes in one direction and security pushes in the other.
Mm.
So it depends on how much of a, you know, it is a slight extra risk. It does draw it up. It does, you know, if it's an HTML email, it uses Internet Explorer to draw up the page.
So in essence, you pull it down off the web server where it's been living, and any potential executable code that's on that same page could also be executed.
It also depends what... email client you're using. So if you're using Outlook or Outlook Express, you might get that sort of behaviour where if there's an embedded image in the email, it will pull it down off the foreign server, and that might expose you to being identified or, you know, someone knowing that you've opened the email or something like that. Other email clients like Thunderbird might act in a more secure way, and I know that mine just refuses point blank to open any images that are embedded in emails.
That's true. Do you choose that deliberately?
Yeah.
Why?
Because it's safer.
Yeah, you reckon you'll get something via a nasty something in a JPEG or something, do you?
Yeah, and
it's all those funny pictures you keep getting that you're sick of.
Well, it's the traceability factor, particularly for spam. One of the things that the spammers really want to know is, did you receive the message or did it go astray? Did anyone actually look at this in the end?
Oh, yeah, they can see.
And what they do is they embed an image in it that's got a unique number as its name. And then when you open up the email, it goes and retrieves that image, and they know that you, personally, you know, Andrew McComb, has opened up that email.
Oh.
So,
scary.
Yeah, so that's why I leave that feature turned off. But then again, it breaks things like the Tech Talk Radio mail out. So
it does. You walk a fine line, don't you?
You do, yeah. So there's always this conflict between, you know, a bit of extra functionality, a bit less security. But, you know, you've got to sort of choose.
Hopefully that answers your question.
Yeah. That's a good question, David.
It was very good.
I've got one more as well from Simon. A question about grey imports. Simon asks, this past week...
I've heard about these
before. Yeah, I've been investigating the purchase of a new phone, looking on eBay and online stores. it appears almost impossible to find genuine Australian stock. Many sellers state they have local stock, but on further investigation, they have their own warranty service indicating they've sourced the stock overseas. Mm. The savings can well be over $100, so the question is whether grey imports are worth the risk.
Yeah, good question.
Mm. Mm. Grey imports means that instead of buying it through the correct supply chain for whatever, you know, it might be a Sony Ericsson phone in this case, buying it through the Sony Ericsson supply chain, they've gone and bought it in a different market, say in Asia somewhere, and then imported it into Australia themselves, so that if you take the phone back to Sony Ericsson under warranty and say, you know, I bought this in Australia and it's broken, they'll say, no, well, this wasn't for sale in Australia, so yeah, we can't help you with fixing it.
There are some companies like my favourite company that actually provide worldwide warranty. So if you've got a product like that,
I'm going to talk about your favourite company and their warranty in just a minute.
So if you've got a product like that, and there's a couple of companies that offer that, then you're pretty well safe for it no matter where you buy it.
I've done that exact thing with Sony Ericsson. I've been overseas in Singapore.
Yep.
And latest and greatest Sony Ericsson PDA phone was there at the time. I thought, you've got to have one of them, and bought it and brought it back here. And it worked fine. Never needed warranty support.
Oh, so you didn't end up taking it back to the Sony.
But the issue always was in the back of my mind, if there was a problem with the phone, what would Sony Ericsson locally... have to say about it.
Yeah, they might say, no, this phone was never for use in Australia, it's unsupported.
Take it back to Singapore.
Bad luck, yeah, send it back to Singapore where you bought it for repair.
Apple, great warranty service department that they have. A colleague of mine who sits in the very opposite, directly opposite me in the office, to be precisely, has an Apple notebook, which under warranty was sent back to the said warranty place where you take said notebooks back to when warranty is required. He's now been without it for 12 weeks.
Excellent. Is that a reseller?
I can't answer that question. I'm not familiar, but he took it back to the place where it was to be done under warranty. And he's since been told that the reason why it's taken so long is that Apple will not ship spare parts until the faulty parts are returned to Apple, then they then ship the new parts. So there's got to be places around town, repair places, which have got, you know, bits of Mac sitting everywhere waiting for other bits to be returned. And that's been the...
So the service centre's got to take the thing apart, pull out the Foley part, send it in a box, send it all the way to America,
yep.
Get it approved, get them to send it back.
Yep.
And then, yeah,
yep. That's what I've been told. It's hearsay. Mm-hmm. So take on board what you want on that. But I just found that amazing when we were talking about it in
You'd
the office
You'd think that
today.
An authorised service centre would have
would
the...
Would carry parts for those sort of things.
And would have the authority to be able to test the part themselves and say, yep, this is faulty, it needs replacing, rather than have to send it back to some...
Which comes down to the reseller. And I haven't actually had to have an Apple product under warranty repaired for a while.
Oh, you're the one.
Very long time. Yeah, I'm the one. That's because I keep on buying old stuff.
I heard there was someone out there. Sorry.
But if you... the old Apple warranty system, which I assume is still around, you used to be able to contact Apple directly. They'd give you a shipping number, and you could actually ship it straight back to Apple to get repaired, rather than go through a reseller who then has to deal with Apple to get spare parts.
But when you say ship it back to Apple, you mean ship it back to the US?
No, Sydney.
Okay.
Well, that's all good and fine, really.
That's even worse if it's gone back to Sydney and it's got that sort of downtime, isn't it? You think, if it had to go somewhere in the US, then, yeah, maybe it's going to take a few extra weeks, but just to Sydney...
Yeah, but then the part has to go back to Sydney to... Yeah.
That's crazy stuff, isn't it?
It is. It's crazy.
Anyway, I just thought I'd air that. I found that amazing in respect to warranty. I know when...
What was the part, do you know? Was it something obscure or something...
Probably the whole motherboard.
It was, actually. It was the motherboard and the enter key. These G4 notebook things, the keys pop off.
The
enter
key, yeah.
Yeah. That one there. Yeah. As Homer says. I just thought I'd mention that because I thought that was... Anyway, what do you expect? There's been a lot of, as we mentioned in my opening piece today, skullduggery going on in the telecommunications industry. And I was in the news today, I thought, oh, what are we breeding here with all these different manufacturers and things like that? The supplier of Soul, well, I don't know, have you heard of Soul Communications? They were...
You've got to have Soul.
Yeah, they were bought out recently by TPG.
Yeah.
And Kath Hart, who writes for the Australian IT, opened a piece about them like this. They seek him there. They seek him here, they seek him there. His staff, associates and reporters seem to seek him everywhere. After weeks of trying to establish whether mid-tiered telco Soul is in cash flow heaven or management hell, some telco types have begun to liken the company's new boss, David Teo, to none other than the Scarlet Pimpernel.
Oh.
Now, that's the type of people running these telcos at the moment. Does it make you wonder why things aren't too flash in certain areas? So,
what's happening with them at the moment? No one knows.
I'm not sure, but Seoul was in a lot of trouble there for a while, to the point where they looked like they were going to disappear, but I think these TPG came in and bought them.
They've disappeared into TPG. Yeah.
They're threatening court cases from some of their resellers and distributors, saying that they're not getting their commissions and they're going to have to go out of business, so they're seeking restitution. And
they had a massive marketing campaign here not so long ago. Or maybe it's still running.
They still do.
Spent a lot of money on TV.
Lots of prime time TV commercials.
Yeah.
I'm still trying to find another article because there was another gentleman in the same industry. Here we go. I found it. Also today, mobile phones. You know, these telecommunications companies. Less than 2 years after investigating a stock market listing, a mobile phone retail chain chaired by member of the Communications Minister Stephen Conroy's expert broadband panel has been found by the federal court to have engaged in calculated dishonesty and continuing deceit by withholding commission payments to its franchisees.
That was all phones, wasn't it?
Oh, you got it anyway. You've been reading the papers. What is it with these telecommunications companies and trying to do the dodgy? Like, is margins just that sort of small in this game?
They probably are pretty tight, their margins.
And is that why they're trying to do everything they can to hang on to every shekel that they can?
Maybe.
The more I sort of hear about this industry, the more dubious it sort of becomes. And it's at all ends of the playing field, from the small guys to the big guys. They're all...
I think the way they work is that they buy up in bulk. They buy up circuit time or call minutes. So they might say to the person up the stream from them, if they're going to be a Telstra reseller or a Vodafone reseller, yeah, we're going to buy 500,000 call minutes from you this week, and we want a good price, please. I think that's how they make their money, yeah, and they buy up in bulk, the same way that that it's done for landlines and other services. So that there wouldn't be much margin in it, though. No.
Okay. Well, if you know, feedback@techtalkradio.com.au is our email address. And even before we get to the rundown, China in a microchip Olympic crackdown. Spectators at the Beijing Olympic opening ceremony, which is going to potentially include Mr. Rudd, our Prime Minister, will be subject to unprecedented security checks to head off any embarrassing protests against the Chinese government. Chinese Olympic organisers have announced that everyone attending the opening ceremony
is going to be microchipped.
Basically, you took the words right out of my mouth.
You're not serious.
Which begins on the 8th of August, the 8th at 8 p.m. will have their tickets embedded with a microchip that will contain their photograph, passport details, address, email address, and telephone number.
So only microchipping the tickets, not the people.
Yes.
Bank account information. Oh.
Yes. But it's... Yes. Anyway, you can draw your own conclusions to that.
So we're not going to be able to print up our own fake Olympics tickets.
Well, they are in the country.
That's
which
not
is
really in the Chinese spirit of the way of doing things, is it?
Absolutely.
No spam
cheap fake BeijingOlympics.com. Yeah.
Well, I'm sure you can reverse engineer the chip, but when you walk through the gantry to get into the airport and the train station and you try to visit the wrong place.
Yes, there'll be these officials following you. It'd be a bit like, did you have the blue tablet or the red tablet?
Yes. This is why we need microchips in people, because it'd avoid all this sort of problem, them having to roll out their own new ticket system and have all this sort of alarmist news appearing in the media. We just
seen a film like that with Tom Cruise, haven't I?
Yeah.
Was it Minority Report or something like that?
Might have been. Yeah. Just need to chip everybody.
Anyway, that's
so they started having that guy we were talking about a few months ago that chipped himself so he could open his front door.
Yeah, he's on the right track. It's a lot to be said, I reckon.
Yeah, it's at birth. They'll just, what do you call them? Medical people? What's the term?
Subcutaneous.
That's the one. I actually said
subcutaneous
that word.
Subcutaneous implants.
I said that word on the ABC the other day. They're very impressed.
Were they?
Anyway, before we go to the break, we should do something else on the rundown. Bill Gates has promised multi-touch Windows in 7. Let me start again. Multi-touch Windows 7.
Yeah, look over here. Don't look at Vista. Look over here. Yeah,
exactly. We've bypassed Vista completely. Yeah. We've gone to the next operating system.
Does that mean that somebody's introduced it into a commercial product already?
Yeah, it could be. Windows 7, the successor to the much criticised Windows Vista, will come with multi-touch features that Microsoft chairman Mr. Bill Gates predicts will ultimately replace the mouse.
That's good. I was about to ask, does that mean I'm going to need two mouses? One to stretch things out or whatever?
Yeah, to click and drag and stretch, you will.
Use your fingers.
Use your fingers. But somebody already does that on a well.
I know. Take a lead from the other manufacturer who's doing that flicking and yes.
It's been done before.
Yeah. Microsoft are catching up again.
Good on them.
Due for release in 2010, 2011, 2012, and 2013. Windows. I just added that bit. Windows 7 will come with a touchscreen interface that will allow users. It says 2010. That will allow users to enlarge and shrink photos, trace routes on maps, paint pictures on. Even play the piano.
Yes, so because one of the most important things I do on my PC in the course of my normal working day is resizing photographs.
Yeah. Oh. What I want to know is, will Windows 7 still come with paint?
Finger paint. What I want to know seriously is...
What a trademark.
We can buy generic touch screens, can't we? We can buy...
Yes.
Yes.
You can put a film over an existing monitor.
Yeah, that's all right.
But the trick is the multi-touch, though, having more than one point.
Yeah, and my mind immediately leapt to the thought, are we going to have to buy proprietary Microsoft hardware to use this feature in Windows 7, or is it going to be able to be adapted to work with generic touchscreen technology?
Microsoft haven't normally gone down the generic hardware pathway. No, my suspicion is that you're going to have to buy a multi-touch screen to use the multi-touch features. Your single-touch screens that you're using now won't support multi-touch.
But manufacturers will start to produce such screens.
Yep.
Very good.
It's on the cards. Before we go to the break, Dr. Ron, what's going on with eBay and your mum? You were telling me this on the phone.
Oh,
it was a very hilarious
can you mention
of
the war?
Story.
Oh. No.
Is this a sort of generation?
I'm selling. There's another story actually about a lady who was selling her baby on eBay. We might get to that a bit later. That was almost an odd spot. It was an odd spot candidate. No, I'm not selling my mother on eBay, but she was trying to buy things on eBay, and she was complaining that if she waited until there was a minute left to run on an auction, and then she went in there and tried to put in a quick bid, and the page actually took 40 or 50 seconds to load. That she missed out.
Yep. You need a sniping program.
Oh, you do need a sniping program. I didn't actually mention that to
her. What's a sniping program for those who don't know?
First of all, let me say, if you're going to leave auctions to the very, very last minute, you just need to be aware that if your internet connection is slow or eBay is momentarily unusually busy and you miss out, then you're going to miss out. You really just need to put on what you expect to pay or what you expect is a reasonable amount to pay, put that on and let it run. Let it run the course of the auction.
And people do that anyway because that's how the fast bid comes back at you if you underprice and you get the next one back. It's because, let's say if someone said, I'm prepared to pay $100 for this and your mum's going, oh, look, it's only 50, I'll put 60 on it. Well, it's going to be counteracted with 65 by the automatic Microsoft bidder on the other person's behalf.
Exactly. What JD is talking about is sniping programs.
Now, what's a sniping program?
Well, there are third-party sites which will offer this sort of a function, so it's automated. So
they sit on roofs with guns, do they?
Well, they do. They sit on the eBay auctions and they watch them down to the second, and they say, "What are you prepared to pay?" And they will put bids in on your behalf at the 30-second mark, at the 15-second mark,
the
10-second mark to run.
Yeah, you have to give them your account details. Whereas if you get something on your own machine, I use a little JavaScript called JBidWatcher, I think it's called. And therefore I don't have to give away my passwords and account details to a third party.
Type it into a third party program, so you still don't know what that program's going to do with it. Might send it off to somebody else.
True, except it's open source and there's lots of feedback and
you're pretty comfortable with it.
So you can
set on this particular application when you want it to bid, so it can be an hour out if you really want to, or in my case 5 seconds away. I think, I do a fair bit of online purchasing for my Macintosh collection, which is just getting a bit out of control at the moment, but what I find is that for the last decade or so, what I find is that people aren't really putting those, the big auction bids in early. They're doing it very, very late, and I certainly do that. I put in a sniping bid at the end that's as much as I can afford so that I haven't boosted the price too early.
Do you have to pay to use these third-party sniping applications?
Or what I've got, no.
Open source. Be free, wouldn't it?
Yeah, I think there's some which are, it's all web-based and you do it on using the web.
Were you using somebody else's product?
Yeah, you may have to pay for those. I'm not entirely sure. Let us know, though, if you've used such a service. feedback@techtalkradio.com.au.
Recently on Tech Talk Radio, we heard Ben-Hur Castro from Seagate in the United States talk about the new generation of portable hard drives, which not only backs up your files with the push of a button, it also password protects the contents of your drive.
Not only does the Maxtor OneTouch 4 Plus provide backups, data storage and protection for your files, it also protects your entire computer system in case of disaster. Now for the good news. Thanks to Maxtor, Tech Talk Radio has a 1TB version of the OneTouch to give away to a lucky Tech Talk Radio listener. Anywhere in the world, valued at $299. All you have to do is visit the Tech Talk Radio website and tell us in a few short words why you need 1TB of storage. How easy is that? We'll announce the winner on air on Monday the 16th of June. So what are you waiting for? Visit techtalkradio.com.au right now and you could be the proud owner of a 1TB OneTouch portable hard drive.
Have you heard something on Tech Talk Radio worth talking about? Are you looking to share your technical dilemmas or opinions with like-minded Tech Talk Radio listeners? Well, now you can. Introducing the Tech Talk Radio web forum. Visit forum.techtalkradio.com.au and join our community. It's free and on a web browser near you.
I neglected to say earlier about our competition, which is going very well at the moment. Thank you to everyone who's sending in those competition entry details for our Maxtor 1GB.
No.
1TB. I'm sorry. That's a Freudian slip, isn't it? The old days. Yeah, 1TB drive. Yeah, it's huge.
It is.
I've got 1GB drives if you want them.
in the hard drive collection.
Are they SCSI or IDE?
A bit of everything.
Do you know uses the box for a doorstop opener now? That's what that's come to.
1TB is 1,000GB.
A lot of information you get on that. And there's been some really good entries as to what people can do with their terabyte.
Oh, yes.
And when I do get a spare moment, I will pop them up on the Tech Talk Radio website for everyone to have a bit of a look at. Because there's a lot of people blaming partners for deleting photos and things like that.
Oh, no.
If you haven't already, be sure to enter because then you're in it for the chance. We're going to draw the raffle, as they say, on the 16th of this month, which is not too far down the track. So you never know, you might be the winner or the proud owner.
Is it just random from amongst the people that that provide a good reason, or do we pick the best reason?
No. What we do, chop up all the names and put them into a hat, and well, I think we've got a guest in on that night, and the guest can choose the draw from the rabbit.
Right.
Out of the hat and see who wins the drive, I reckon.
That's in 2 weeks.
Yeah, in about 2 weeks' time.
Very good.
Yeah. Wow. Toshiba unveils another Blu-ray killer. Toshiba's working on an extension to the DVD format, which will offer video quality comparable to that produced by the Blu-ray and HD DVD discs, according to a Japanese media report. Here we go again.
Why?
Yes, good question. The company plans to begin selling a DVD player based on the new technology within 6 months. Why? It's a very good question.
Because they can. Well, it's a new product, more money.
You would have thought they would have learnt by their experiences in previous times, wouldn't you?
There's just been the most monumental, significant, enormous format war since VHS versus Beta, which has been won decidedly by Blu-ray.
Yeah, and February 2008.
Toshiba have come out and said, well, actually, let's just try and have another little format that we're going to invent for high definition.
But what's changed? I mean, I suppose we had different speeds for vinyl and we had different formats for tape and nothing really changed.
You're all in favour of it, you reckon?
Oh, no, I'm not in favour of it.
Competition and...
You asked why, I think. It's money.
The new DVD player will be backwards compatible with standard DVD discs. And one Japanese report appeared to suggest that the new technology would be able to produce much higher resolution images from existing DVDs, but did not address the apparent impossibility of this claim. What is going on in the tech world at the moment? We've got telco companies lying and deceiving. We've got manufacturers producing scuttlebutt at a ferocious rate. We've got manufacturers that don't warrant their warranties. Like, really, what hope have consumers got?
It must be very confusing for consumers who don't understand the technology behind some of these claims and what ones are more real than others.
Absolutely.
But it's an interesting point. If they are putting high definition onto standard DVD discs, like fitting it into the 4.7 or 9 odd gigabytes you get on a DVD,
then that seems to me to be a good move, because at the moment I'm using MPEG-4 type formats. This is the DivX or those sorts of formats. You can get many, many more hours of standard def on a DVD than you can on a DVD mm-hmm. format DVD. So why not use that sort of compression technology to put high def? You might be able to get an hour and a half of high def on a standard DVD using the MPEG-4 compression or that sort of compression.
Enough for a couple of episodes of a TV program.
Yeah, or a short movie about a bee or something.
A little bee.
I was snooping around in the white goods shops the other day because my set-top box has decided to become more of a boat anchor than a set-top box at the moment. And the Blu-ray prices still haven't come down any. They're still sitting up there at the big bucks sort of thing. But I know someone who can answer our questions, Adam Turner. And this is his view from the couch for this week.
Adam Turner's view from the couch on Tech Talk Radio.
The high-def format war would seem to be over. So why aren't we rushing to embrace Blu-ray? Blu-ray sales actually plummeted 40% from January to February. This could be dismissed as a statistical blip, were it not for the fact that it only rose a mere 2% from February to March. HD DVD may be dead and buried, but consumers apparently aren't ready to take the plunge into Blu-ray just yet. Why? It's not that people don't own big televisions to watch Blu-ray on. LCD televisions and, to a lesser extent, plasmas are running out the door down at the local electrical bulk discount store. Admittedly, a lot of these televisions are junk, but suburbanites are blinded by screen size with little appreciation for picture quality. The best plasmas look better than the best LCDs, I don't care what anyone says, but plasma seems destined to go the way of HD DVD, thanks to yet another smear campaign from Sony. Sony's trash-talking during the Blu-ray versus HD DVD war was enough to make Muhammad Ali blush, and since Sony abandoned the plasma market, plasma televisions have copped the same treatment. Sony makes some of the best LCDs around, but Pioneer plasmas still put them to shame. Price is obviously a factor in the take-up of Blu-ray. The early adopters are already on board with Blu-ray or HD DVD, and the second wave of discerning buyers jumped on board late last year when Blu-ray's victory looked certain. With those two market segments taken care of, it's now coming down to mainstream consumers. For many of them, I'd say $300 is the magic point at which an AV device becomes a cash and carry item rather than a well-considered purchase. That's still a year or two away. After price, it comes down to the fact your average shopper wouldn't know a quality television if it bit them on the arse. Of course, that's partly because of the terrible job some retailers do of setting up displays, along with the misinformation that spews forth from some sales assistants. It's also because your average punter has never sat a 50-inch Pioneer Curo plasma and a 50-inch Sony Bravia LCD next to each other in their lounge room and compared all the formats until their family begged for mercy. Consumer ignorance, or perhaps just complacency with existing formats, is why the general public rarely embraces new technologies as fast as the digerati would expect. The DVD player was 10 years old before it outnumbered the humble VCR in lounge rooms. It took a decade, even though the advantages of DVD players were obvious even to the non-tech savvy, you didn't need a new television, and there wasn't a format war to confuse the issue. I'd say today the confusion over Blu-ray and HD DVD, DVD and hard drive recorders, personal video recorders, digital television, and the various definitions of high definition means that punters are happy to sit on the VCRs for a little longer, until the upgrade decision becomes truly idiot-proof. Those who believe video on demand and other such technologies have already made Blu-ray irrelevant are delusional. Consumer behaviour suggests it will be a long time before Blu-ray or even ordinary DVDs are dead and buried. Of course, when I say a long time, I mean at least 5 years, which is an eternity in technology. Realistically, I'd say it's closer to 10 years. I think it's fair to say that Blu-ray will probably be the last physical video format, but it's crazy to say that it'll shuffle off this mortal coil anytime soon. As for the uninformed masses, they don't seem to appreciate that your television needs to be at least 37 inches and 1080p to see the difference between Blu-ray and an upscaled DVD. As such, it's no surprise that upscaling DVD players seem to be the hot ticket item at the moment. They don't actually convert DVD images into true 1080p,
they just take an educated guess as to where the extra pixels should go to make the DVD look a bit sharper. Most Blu-ray and HD DVD players also upscale DVDs, which is why some people are using the demise of HD DVD to pick up a cheap upscaling DVD player that just happens to play HD DVD as well. If you can pick up some of your favourite movies cheap on HD DVD, maybe this will be enough to tide you over until Blu-ray prices drop. HD DVD's blood is still fresh on the streets, Blu-ray prices remain high, and consumers are still coming to terms with new technology. Sony and its allies can crow about Blu-ray's victory as much as they want, but shoppers aren't prepared to come out of hiding just yet.
Entertaining, informative, and independent. You're listening to Tech Talk Radio.
A disturbing report there from Adam Turner. Sorry, Anna. So there you go. There's the lowdown on HD. I must admit, I have seen Blu-ray, and let me tell you, high-definition television and Blu-ray, there's no comparison. If you've got a high-definition television set, you'd be sure to have a Blu-ray player, because nothing will beat high-definition from that calibre. Because in this country, they squash it down so much that it actually looks like standard def coming out the other end. Have you got a high-def, Dr. Ron?
I do.
Can you notice the difference between standard def and high-def to a degree that you should be able to notice?
Depending on the program, yes.
Yeah?
There are some programs.
What do you watch in high definition that's you go, wow?
I haven't done it for a long time, but I can remember putting several programs through the hoops when I first got the television, and I could notice a difference. One of them was one of the morning shows that's produced here, like either one of the Sunrise programs or on the commercial television, and flicking between the high definition channel and the standard definition channel, you could see a difference. It was a lot sharper, and the high def picture did jump out at you. So.
Well, high def's great when it's in high def, and it's really high def, because it does. It looks fantastic. I had the pleasure of dining with some people in the industry the other night, and they were telling me about their dilemmas of high definition and getting, like, say, for example, an outside broadcast feed from a football ground back to the place where it's broadcast from. And a lot of their problems lay in just that, getting it from A to B in the true high def format. And then you've got the other dilemmas, as I think we were discussing in audio the other day, with digital delays and audio delays and things like that, because like everything, television's done on the cheap, and you find that the cameras out in the field are certainly high definition, but the guys take a standard definition split out of them to look at them on their monitors, and they look completely different to what high definition looks like, and everything's a frame delayed on their audio, so it's just a minefield out there now with audio and high def. So.
And that, as they say, a chain is only as strong as its weakest link.
Yeah, it's like getting stuck behind the old little 1963 V-dub on the Autobahn. You're not going to go fast.
That's right. You've got a piece of cheap equipment in there somewhere, or someone's skimped on something, then it's going to have a follow-on effect all the way down the chain.
Absolutely. Now, let's talk a little bit more about eBay, because we were talking about this with your mum's dilemma before.
Yeah.
Google had a bit of a bash at eBay the other day.
They did. This was in the news, I think, Graham, wasn't it?
That's Graham, yes. I'm Andrew, yeah.
No, sorry.
I didn't mention you in the news, you're quite right.
Mm. Who's that person behind you? No, don't go there. Google was left red-faced yesterday when it, on Sunday, I think it was, left yesterday when it was outed as the annoyance source feeding the submission to the competition regulator, damning the proposal by rival eBay. Whoops-a-daisy. Someone let the cat out of the bag. Google quickly distanced itself from a report that it had submitted a scathing document to the Australian Competition and Consumer Commission, which was against eBay's proposal to mandate the use of PayPal on the auction site. In a move that has angered online auction sellers around the world, eBay plans by June the 17th to ban all forms of payment, except with the exception of cash on delivery and PayPal, which is owned by eBay.
Hmm.
Have you had any more thoughts on this panel? Is this good? Is this bad? Does it really matter?
I don't know. We're going to have to wait and see what people do. People are going to vote with their feet, and if they're going to go to other online auction sites, then that's a good thing.
Do you think there are other credible online auction sites, or are eBay big enough to be, you know...
Well, this is the problem, isn't it?
Like, the only one that's worth using.
eBay's probably the most well-known.
Well, it's a monopoly now, really, isn't it?
If you think of an online auction, you go to eBay.
GoFish.
Yeah, I do. Yeah.
A long time ago.
GoFish. That was a very early one.
What about Grays? Grays online auctions.
Yeah, Grays online will be coming a close second, but they're still a long way behind eBay.
Yeah. Maybe this will push the popularity stakes of other auction software packages like this up in the air.
It might split the people might go to various of the other ones, and it might become a much more
I can see the pros and cons on both sides of the fence, though. Mm. It's an interesting one. If you were a consumer buying just little tidbits on eBay, it probably wouldn't be too bad. But if you're trying to sell, if you're running a store online, that's going to
be... And you accepted credit card payments as a matter of course.
Yeah. But then again, chances are, depending on your merchant facility, eBay, I think, take 3% of your transaction, which is what the banks do on the big guys anyway, so... Oh, we'll watch and see. Property options.
They're going to charge the seller, aren't they, for selling something on eBay? Yep. And they're going to charge the buyer for making a PayPal transaction.
Absolutely. They get double hit, double whack. Mm. Property auctions hit the web now, too. We've become accustomed to using online auction technology, so why not bring property auctions to the web? Now buyers can watch and even bid at an auction using technology in a website called ptyauctions.com.au.
I thought you were going to say eBay, and you just have to pay for your house with PayPal.
At $10,000 a throw, you'd have to do multiple transactions.
You'd hit their ceiling on that one, especially the way property prices are going right here. Managing Director Gavin Stewart, who developed the idea, was an investment banker involved in the commodities era. The system was first used for international bidding on coffee crops, would you believe? And he's now taken the idea to property, believing it will open up auctions to international buyers as well as those within Australia. Well, why not? You can buy anything else on the internet these days, can't you?
What was the name of the site again?
PTY Auctions. Well, you're dialing it up. All the laptops are out here on the bench here. PTYauctions.com.au.
I'll have to have a look. Interesting.
You can buy a house online.
Yeah.
Well, if you could bid online... Wonder if you can get your spruiking software. What did you call it? Your third-party...
Sniping
software to buy your house for you.
Maybe.
It's pretty big numbers floating around on an eBay auction. Or the equivalents thereof.
Yes.
Yeah. Mobile phones are showing a strong growth in Australia. I would have thought this would be a very mature market by now.
A saturated market.
Absolutely. Every man, woman, child, dog and amoeba has got a mobile phone.
Are there
still
people who haven't got mobile phones?
Well, apparently sales grew by 13.4% for the first 3 months of 2008 to, guess what, 294.3 million units. That's not bad for a country with 21 or 22 million people, isn't it? You do the maths.
So what's going on here? Do people need two or three mobile phones, or do people, you know, regularly leave them on the roof of the car or drop them in the loo, or what's going on here?
I know my wife can wash them quite regularly.
Oh, yeah.
She won't even wait to
wear
out a
lot of that going on, do you?
Oh, look, I don't know, but that's a lot of phones. 294.3 million units.
What's the life expectancy of a mobile phone these days? If you have...
The length of the contract.
Yeah, exactly.
No, not even that these days.
Yeah, as soon as you can get away with replacing it, you do, because you get the newest one.
Yeah, the newest, the biggest and the best.
And it does better ringtones, and it sounds better, and it's got the flashing blue light on it or something.
Yeah,
so, yeah.
It supports new audio file formats, and it's got more megapixels in its camera, and more online services are available, and all that good stuff.
Yeah.
I get one every 2 years.
It'll be why it's so high. It'll be every 2 years people will be replacing them. What we need to see is a statistic beside that which shows how often mobile phones are disposed of.
Well, I guess Mobile Muster and those sort of people where you drop your phone off to get it recycled, I wonder if they're seeing the increase as well.
May well be.
Have you got all those batteries? Oh, that'd be good for the environment, wouldn't it?
Yes, could be disastrous.
Have you got a desk drawer somewhere at home which has got 8 unused mobile phones in it?
Yeah, I have.
We do, but we actually give them to the kids to use. And they're the best toys out because then they can break those rather than the real ones. And, of course, the cameras still work in them, and they reckon it's great. So for absolutely nothing, the kids get a digital camera which they can go around and go snap, snap, snap. And if they drop the phone in the loo, as you're saying, Graham, or if they, leave it outside in the rain, or it doesn't matter. It's an old, dead phone which is no longer in service anyway.
That's a good idea. Yeah.
Don't you need a SIM card in the phone?
Not to take pictures, no.
No?
And you can SMS them to the emergency operators too.
Good. Oh, that's great. Oh,
I'm sure they appreciate that.
I think they're trying to fix that now. So, yes, but no, you don't need a SIM card in a phone to actually use any of the facilities that are on it, apparently. You only need it to make phone calls, apparently.
Okay.
Local credit card fraud is really taking off too. This is all the people, this is probably why eBay wants to go to PayPal and all that. But in Australia, fraud on a locally issued credit cards are jumping to a whopping $111.5 million last year, up from $85 million in 2006, according to the Australian Payments Clearing Association. There were 1.76 billion credit card transactions on credit cards issued in Australia, with a total value of $251 billion. And if you think of that, half of that, $111.5 million of that was fraudulent last year. A lot of people nicking cards, isn't there? You've got to be so careful with them.
It's a big problem.
Yeah. Maybe they should, bring a credit card down from 2 years to 1 year or something. It might be more credit card, more plastic, but at least if they change things a little bit more frequently, like expiry dates, would that help the situation?
Well, the numbers don't change usually. If you have a
credit card...
No,
but your expiry date does.
Yeah, but,
nothing actually... It's interesting. Nothing actually checks that expiry date when you validate the card.
Really?
Yeah. You check that it's not expired... But nothing. You don't need the right expiry date to match with the card in most cases.
Oh, you're doing the way my system works in the Commonwealth Bank. You do. Well,
you need to put it in. It needs to match.
Absolutely.
Do a test for me next time. You have to punch your credit card number and your expiry date into
just
a web page.
Drop a couple of months off it.
Or just say your expiry date is. I mean, it's currently June 08. Just say my expiry date is July 08. And see if it passes. You might be surprised to find that it does.
It probably needs an expiry date, and it probably needs to be in the future, but it probably doesn't need to be right.
Mm.
It's the numbers. And your problem, if you keep reissuing cards and keep changing the numbers, I'm running out of numbers. We'll need to add a 9 on the front or something.
There's a telephone number.
There's a telco that did that recently, wasn't it?
Well, some Austel organisation that did it.
Yes. You'll find, if you're interested in this technology, there are web pages around that explain how the checksums work.
Oh, yes.
You have to have a certain digits in a certain order, which have to, when you analyse those digits mathematically, they come up with a number of acceptable results. So you can't just invent a credit card number off the top of your head.
If you know the rules now.
Well, if you know the rules,
those algorithms can be plugged into generating software. Surely that's
how
they can.
Well, they can, and they're out there. And they're out there.
An email from Andrew Mowat, if I've pronounced your name, surname correctly.
Hi, Andrew.
I got the first bit right, because that's me. we were talking a bit about the telcos previously and getting money and how they set their systems up to try and break even. And he said, we were right. The telcos were much the same way as ISPs, whereby you buy blocks of time, calls, bandwidth, and then aggregate your calls usage across a user base.
Yep.
The bigger the usage base, the easier it is to make profit, as it's all done on a razor-sharp margin. And, of course, the more users you have, the more bargaining power you have with the wholesale telcos to get a better price. But, as he says, if you exceed your wholesale minutes, then your profits get eaten up by companies like Sol, and they've based their model on the tightest of margins, and this can tip them over the edge.
So they're on a plan like we, the end users, are on plans.
You might be on a $99 plan. They're on a $10,000
plan. They're on $99 million plan.
It still works the same way. That's the same way.
Absolutely. Just hope you're not buying through Optus, because you'll get a really big bill.
And the problem is that, the competition, the other telco across the road or around the corner is trying to do the same thing. And, if you have a little bit more extra, leeway in your plan, then, you're going to go out of business.
Absolutely. Another email in from one of our listeners. Good evening to Jeff Dudley. One of my sons has an interesting iPod problem. He recently reformatted his hard disk drive and reinstalled Windows XP Pro. Everything works perfectly except for iTunes. Windows knows about the iPod. It's there, and it says it needs to be installed iPod drivers, and it says found new hardware, etc., but it says it can't find the driver.
Buy SanDisk. Use your mobile phone.
There you go, Jeff. Hopefully that solved your problem.
Whatever. Damn iTunes. Damn it to hell, I say. What good is it? What good is it, JD?
It works quite well on my Mac.
Works quite well on my PC. It manages my... I'm dreading having to move to another...
The bigger problem isn't so much finding the drivers for your iPod, because that should actually just work. But the problem is keeping your identifier so that when you log back into iTunes, all your music still works and is credited. So.
Oh, that's right. When you buy, the DRM kicks in and says, no, you're not really who you claim you are. No, we're not going to let you play that song.
Yeah. Now, there's lots of websites online, because I've had to do this for a couple of machines. My wife's in particular just recently.
She's listening tonight. Be careful what you say.
Hi, Jen. So there's lots of websites out there telling you which files you need to back up and take with you when you do a reinstall. So just make sure you've checked that out before you decide to put a new version of XP on.
That's a good tip if you're migrating from one machine to another.
So the app, is it, that sort of takes your settings? Or you
There probably is, but all I've really seen is a list of directories that you just back up onto a CD or a floppy drive, if you've still got one, and take with you.
Oh, that's good. I didn't know that. Now we do. See, this is what this show's all about. You learn something every day.
Yeah, otherwise you'd have problems when you'd lose all the, even if it was just stuff that you copied off your own CDs, you'd still lose the synchronise facility to your iPod.
There you go, Jeff. Hopefully probably not the answer you're after, but anyway, it's got a level of discussion. Speaking of discussion, GPS units giving dodgy directions. Now, this is just because we can. Motorists are being led astray by high-tech GPS devices as Victoria police are forced to rescue motorists ending up on out-of-the-way country
okay.
traffic.
Graham's got a migraine.
Listen up, people. Okay, everybody out there, when you own a GPS, when you switch on your GPS, you do not switch off your brain. If the GPS tells you to turn left onto the train tracks, don't do it. If the GPS tells you to turn right at Camberwell Junction, where there's no right turns for those people who don't know, don't do it. Just drive, do something safe, drive straight ahead, you know, follow the traffic directions, you know.
Hey, that explains all the people on the freeway that cut from the right-hand lane right across to the left-hand lane to exit.
Yeah, because...
I always thought they were just idiots, but they're actually following...
They're following their GPS.
They're GPS-enabled idiots.
Don't cross 18 lanes of traffic to get off the freeway at the right exit. Just keep going. Your GPS will recalculate a new way to get to where you're going perfectly safely without driving down the train tracks or falling off a cliff or getting lost or turning right at Camberwell Junction.
Or driving over a bridge that's not there.
That's right. Just, you know, bit of common sense, people, please.
Graham, have we hit a personal note here or something? You're very passionate about this.
We might have, yeah.
Okay.
I'll calm down now.
Okay, good. Police urge drivers not to turf out old-fashioned maps and more rely on the GPS system to find their way. A member stationed in Bright in Victoria's Alpine District says motorists are becoming lost after blindly following their directions. And up in the sky country of Victoria, it's probably not a good idea because there's some fairly steep and inhospitable tracks up in that part of the world. They went on to say that they had to help two motorists in the past 6 weeks who ended up on roads suited for four-wheel drive vehicles, with the most recent incident leaving a family with a young child stranded on a slippery hill in Tea Tree Range. There you go. Bright Senior Sergeant Doug Incoles said GPS-directed drivers on the quickest possible route are not the safest particular route.
And it hasn't even started snowing yet.
Yes. Oh, well,
it's good to hear from the Bright Senior Sergeant.
It is.
Yeah. Anyway. It must be very bright, yeah.
All right, let's, moving right along. We are going to take a break, and when we come back, we're going to have part two of our discussion with Rico Malva, who runs the Microsoft's development department over there. We heard part one last week, so feel free to download or listen to last week's podcast to hear the beginning of this. And as we've, some of our emails and correspondence have alluded to this evening, there was a question about the synthetic voice of Microsoft, but no, it's not Rico. But anyway, that's the tyranny.
It's not. It's not.
It's not. It's the tyranny of distance. There's something between the telephone lines from one side of the world to the other. But nonetheless, we'll pick up with that conversation after this.
Compelling.
Every once in a while, a revolutionary product comes along that changes everything.
Judicious.
The question is really whether young people particularly are addicted to being connected to other people all the time.
Historical.
Today is a very important day in Australia's history. This is the day, the 6th of October, in 2006, that life in Australia will be changed forever.
Caring.
I know as a parent, I would often say to my children, you've just spoken to this person for 8 hours at school, how can you sit online and chat to them for another 5 hours?
You heard of road rage? What about web rage?
They should be wearing a mask and carrying a gun.
Relations between Telstra and the federal government have been extremely strained almost from the moment Sol Trujillo became chief executive.
Optus have again had quite a good quarter, but its 3G service is very low profile at the moment.
And the Queen's got an iPad.
Eddie's got one.
Yeah.
I wonder what she listens to.
She'll probably listen to us.
An unexpectedly high number of voters swamped in the system. Well, what did they expect?
Controversial.
Less attention is paid to the equally interesting question, should journalists blog?
Magical.
And I've got some residual powers.
Ambitious.
High-speed broadband, it's available in most of Asia as well as being in the rest of the world. Let's just make sure that we can get it in Australia this year, not next.
Religion.
Talking to the Roman Catholics, I have been on Vatican Radio.
Comedy.
You put the date on E-Pray, and you get a whole service. Just on. How does it go? It goes.
Insightful, entertaining, and informative. Tech Talk Radio. More than just technology.
It's a strictly rehearsed and finely polished program.
Welcome back to Tech Talk Radio. Last week we heard part one of our interview with Rico Malva, the head of research for Microsoft in the United States. So we'll pick up where we left off, talking to Rico about how we're going to interact with devices of the future and the presentation of the information contained within.
Besides the interaction,
There is also how we're going to present information to you in new ways that will allow you navigation through information in a very cool way. For example, we have this thing called Worldwide Telescope that it's not released yet, but it will be soon, late spring or summer. And we already have a site that is worldwidetelescope.org. And the idea is that you're probably familiar with Live Local, for example, where you can see a satellite picture of a city and then you can navigate through it, right? So you can move around to the left, to the right, and zoom. Imagine that through the whole universe. So now you navigate through the galaxies and with zoomable interfaces, and you can zoom into the Earth and then see the Earth, or you can get close to a galaxy. And with an additional ability of recording a journey that you've made through the universe and then save that to a friend. So almost as if you're playing around the universe and you visited it in a particular way, and then that journey you can send a link to your friend, and then they can see your experience and go through the same pathways you've gone. And you have the whole universe in front of you. So it's really a very cool experience.
I could imagine for education it'd be fantastic. How real time would that be? Like, would you be able to see, obviously, space moves relatively slowly, but would you be able to watch, stellar experiences, a supernova exploding or a comet traveling through the universe and see where it is in relatively real time? Is that sort of the technology where we're aiming to be?
That would be super cool. That's not what we can do today. Today what we're basically doing is picking up data from many different kinds of astronomic databases, from observatories and other places and telescopes, and putting them together and seamlessly allowing you to navigate from one to the other. But in the future, once we have enough connections with real data, for example, from an observatory in particular, yes, we could actually do that. Probably not to the entire universe, because we actually don't have data feed for that, but on a particular telescope to which we can have a live feed, sure, we could provide to you exactly that kind of experience. We can't do that today, but we could probably do in the future.
The benefit of that would definitely be the fact that if you can't see it on one side of the world, you could see it on the other side of the world just by logging in and searching through the Worldwide Telescope. I think that would be a fantastic educational experience for everybody. Rico,
absolutely.
Let's talk about data storage too. This has traditionally been a little bit restrictive, if for no other reasons than physical limitations of storage devices and even the quantity of records being stored. Some companies have realised that knowledge is power, so how will we be storing our data in the future, and will there be any limits to how much we can store and access at any one point in time?
Well, that's a good point. And in fact, everybody's drowning in data. And one of the problems we run to is that the capacity of the hard disk keep increasing. And today you buy a new computer, let's say a new laptop computer, you get 100 gigabytes of it, of hard disk in it. And unless you're filling it all with movies, which does happen, of course, but if you just think of data and businesses that have computers with lots of data in it, managing all that data gets to be very complicated. So many of the same technologies that we use that allow you to search the web in an efficient way will allow you to search the data that you have. Like, for example, you probably have a laptop and you probably don't know exactly what's in it because you've been putting documents inside.
I've got hard drives like that, Rico. I've got hard drives on my computers. They're so big, you lose things. Will we find these huge data houses offering to store our data almost for no cost? Is that where we're heading?
Yes, that's where we're heading. The idea that because you can store so much, now you have actually a risk of having too much data on a machine that could break, right? And storing that in the cloud somehow so that you have a more reliable way to access your data. Or if your machine broke and you know you have copies of your document in a service, then you can pick up another machine and immediately have access to your information. So these services will already exist to some extent, and they will continue to expand to a point that even you can have, if you have more than one computer, they will be integrated through the cloud. So they're all connected to the internet. They're all connected through the cloud. You change something in your machine, then almost seamlessly the other one gets updated. So your data is kind of safe. It is safe in that way that it's replicated in many places.
Let's talk a little bit about artificial intelligence, because it's been talked about for many years. Some people fear it, some embrace it. Where are we going? What are we likely to see in this form of, or in the next round of technology? Are we going to see things that are getting close to sort of almost knowing what we want to ask it?
Actually, yes. Artificial intelligence, it can mean many things, but in many of the things, you see things in a scalable way. Like, for example, today you're typing at Microsoft Word in a word processor, and today already if you spell something incorrectly or if the grammar is incorrect, it will tell you that. It will underline the words.
A very handy feature.
Well, it's a very handy feature, but we're going to go beyond that. Imagine, for example, you're typing something that is grammatically correct, but maybe the style is not quite that good. And then Word will be able to tell you at some point, some little window will pop up and say, what you just wrote, maybe you would like to rewrite it this way, you know? And you can imagine, especially for people whose English, assuming you're typing in English, is not the first language, then a style checker or a style suggestion system may be very useful. And it will need to have additional levels of intelligence to be able to actually suggest good phrases. Another one is doing machine translation. We actually already have a site on the web with the preliminary offering via live search, but the quality of it will improve very much in the next few years to the point where if you're trying to find something, we can actually search in pages written in other languages and bring the results to you in your language. With the website formatted exactly the way it was formatted in the other language, but then the text translated to your language. And other things you will see is that search today is actually very limiting because you have to open a window that has a particular website, let's say live search, and then you have that little rectangular window where you have to type words. And what you really want is not to type words. You want to find your information. Like, for example, suppose you're writing an article about biology and you want to write about kinds of trees and you want to talk about bushes, and if you just go type bush in search, you're probably going to get a bunch of results about George Bush, let's say. And that's not what you're looking for. And how do we know what you're looking for? The idea is that if we're in your computer and we know what you're working on, that can give us context to make those searches much more efficient for you, to the point where some of them will be implicit. For example, I bet it happened to you that you're preparing, let's say, a PowerPoint presentation, and you're typing some things, and suddenly you realize, I've already done a presentation just like that. I know I have some slides about that. And maybe they were blue or something, but, you know, I don't know where they are in my computer, and I don't even know how to search, because it's a visual memory, right?
Mm-hmm.
But if we know the context of where you're working, we can actually have a window where automatically we're searching related information. So all the times that you're working on something, we can point you to things that are related to that. And maybe if all goes well, we will find that you already had another PowerPoint file with content very similar to the one you're working on. So those clearly will exist very soon.
You mentioned search, which is obviously the interface between, I guess, the human world and the computer world. We recently spoke to Hugh Williams, who's Microsoft's live image search guru, who's actually a Melbourne boy. He's born and bred just down the road here. Do you interact with the guys in search and share experiences and get out the wish list and have a chat to them and see how they can implement the new technology into what they currently have?
Oh, absolutely. We actually have one of our many research groups we call Interactive Visual Media, and they do all kinds of cool things of computer vision and image analysis, and we work very closely with the image search folks. Like, for example, the kind of technology that I mentioned to you where you just point your cell phone camera to anything, take a picture of it, and then search based on that picture. It's something that we actually have working already in our lab. Not 100% working, but almost not quite at the point where we can ship, but it's already working well, and folks like Hugh's team are very interested in this technology. So as soon as we can make it really reliable, they will be very interested in making it available to consumers.
One of the other interesting things, which is near and dear to my heart, is television and high-definition video and sound, which I think is one of your passions too, from what I've been reading. The ability to bring high-definition video and pure sound into our lives has really opened up new global market for movie makers in recent times. How are we going to use these technologies in entertainment in the future? Are we going to see bigger, better, faster, even to a point where, as a television producer, we're sort of scared about, oh, we're going to be making content again for these small PDA cell phone devices. And yet at the other end of the extreme, we're making them for, you know, 50-inch plasma TVs and things like that. Where we were once sort of thinking, oh, fantastic, we're heading down high definition. These PDAs and these new cell phones are coming out. And even the compression systems to actually take these large format information of pictures and sound and squashing them down into these little things that can be sent to cell phones. What's going to happen in this sort of genre for rich media, which is where the web's heading, if this web 2.0 and the interactiveness and the rich color media is anything to be believed?
Yes, you have a good point, because I mean, consumers really like as much fidelity as can get, as they can get. So if you give them high definition audio and video, they want that. But on the other hand, the first thing they want is the content. Now imagine you're in an airport lounge. You're late for a flight and you have nothing to do, and you want to kill your time just watching a movie on your cell phone. Then you download something to your cell phone and you watch on that. But then later you get home and you say, you know what, that was a good movie, but I only saw half an hour of it or something. I really want to. Or maybe I saw it all, but I saw in this low definition. I want to watch it in high definition. But you already have a good part of the content because you've downloaded some of it. So we can give you the rest of it via the internet, for example, because we already knew what you have. So the idea is that you have, you mentioned compression, you have these scalable compression formats where we can give you part of the information and maybe the other part. Another one, for example, if you have enough connectivity among neighbors, if your neighbor downloaded a movie and you want the same movie, maybe the bits for that movie can be delivered to you from that neighbor, right? And if you put the correct systems in place, it's actually better for the internet service provider because they don't need to have as many servers. It's better for us because we don't need to have as many servers. And if users participate, that can actually reduce the cost of downloading the movie, then everybody would be motivated. Basically, if you do a combination of servers and peer-to-peer connections, you can actually, within the existing bandwidth of your connections, deliver more high-fidelity content and high-definition content to everybody.
It's you mentioned the peer-to-peer technology, which is sort of frightening, I think, to a lot of movie producers. I think their business model needs to be adapted so that they can actually embrace the technology rather than shun it. Now, you look what has happened with audio files and music files. They've all gone online. And to a point where if you don't mind compressed music and music where it's sort of tailored for a low bandwidth, obviously bandwidth is not going to be too much of an issue in the future. So admittedly, television theoretically can then be shipped in the same manner that audio is being shipped. Are you sort of in the belief that that's the way we will get our video of the future?
It is. It's because it's unavoidable. I mean, as I told you, with P2P and other technologies like that, so the ability to deliver video content through the internet already exists. And one thing that we still haven't completely figured out the best way is how to do it in an efficient way, which everybody gets the content, but protects the rights of the content owners, so that you don't have unrestricted copies flying all over the place.
You've been involved in digital rights management development, I guess, over time. There must be certain sort of constraints that you have to look at, as in protecting the rights of the owner, but yet making the technology available so that you can a consumer can move it from the player in the living room on the big screen through to their device without infringing copyright, I guess.
Exactly. And it's almost like, If you're in your house and you put too many locks in every door, it becomes a nuisance. You might have more security, but then it's too much nuisance. And that's a basic trade-off, right? How do you deliver something secure, but you don't put too much burden on the user. And in this case, if you just want to authenticate the user, there must be some easy way in which all the user's devices are associated to that user. The certificates are moved from one to the other. And we actually haven't yet figured out the best way of doing that so that ultimately to the user, you do nothing, right? And all the certificates are automatically moved around. So that's an area of research here for us. We have one group that looks a lot into those issues.
The global village, we're seeing a digital divide between the haves and the have-nots. Obviously, in your development, you're looking at rolling out new technologies, which are probably bandwidth hungry. Is there any sort of downscalable model for countries or locations? And I mean, even take, for example, rural Australia, where we have very much a digital divide at the moment. Accessing this type of technology from those remote locations must surely be one factor that you're taking into consideration in developing these technologies?
That's a very good point. I mean, indeed, that happens, but we would like to bring the benefit of connectivity to everybody. So I'll tell you an example of something we did in India, for rural India, where basically we would like the farmers in those very small communities and villages to have access to information that they care about, like, for example, the price of the crop, who are the buyers, who are distributors willing to buy their production and so forth. But it's difficult for them to have some computers, to maintain computers. So we did this project where basically at the cooperative level, we can have a computer to a few that connects to more central databases. And from that, we connect cell phones to those computers. So in the really remote village, all you need to have is cell phone. And by exchanging text messages, you send a text message and you get back. It's a relative primitive interface. But all you need is very basic cell phone access. So before you can actually bring the internet to that village, you can already bring the information that will be important for them and allows them to be more efficient.
And finally, Rico, PDA, cell phones, iPhones seem to be the thing this decade. What do you think will be the can't-live-without gadget of the future? Or are we going to basically see the same sort of devices that we have now just morph into some other obscure device which is yet to be imagined?
That's a good question. We would like to come up with the magic device, the little box that you reach in your pocket and you get the box. And the box does everything for you. And we haven't quite figured that out, so today you carry your laptop, and you carry your Bluetooth headset, and you carry your cell phone. Pretty soon your little carry-on luggage is full of boxes, right?
Mm-hmm.
And we're all looking into how can we eventually make that a one box, and that one box magically will have enough screen area, will have enough interaction ability, so maybe you don't need such a big keyboard and still be super productive. So we are looking into those things and trying to figure out, can we bring the whole thing to the box, the magic box that you carry and you do everything with it.
Rico, good luck in the development of that said magic box. We look forward to it eagerly with bated breath, I suspect. And thank you for sparing some time for Tech Talk Radio. It's been very informative and been a privilege talking to you. Thank you, Rico.
It was a pleasure.
Recently on Tech Talk Radio, we heard Ben-Hur Castro from Seagate in the United States talk about the new generation of portable hard drives, which not only backs up your files with the push of a button, it also password protects the contents of your drive. Not only does the Maxtor OneTouch 4 Plus provide backups, data storage and protection for your files, it also protects your entire computer system in case of disaster. Now for the good news. Thanks to Maxtor, Tech Talk Radio has a 1TB version of the OneTouch to give away to a lucky Tech Talk Radio listener anywhere in the world, valued at $299.
All you have to do is visit the Tech Talk Radio website and tell us in a few short words why you need 1 terabyte of storage. How easy is that? We'll announce the winner on air on Monday the 16th of June. So what are you waiting for? Visit techtalkradio.com.au right now and you could be the proud owner of a 1 terabyte, one-touch portable hard drive.
The panel on Tech Talk Radio.
Who's been on an aeroplane of recent times and had the experience of an e-ticket these days? They're pretty good, aren't they?
Dispense with paper tickets now.
Yeah, globally as opposed to locally now. In the mother of all paper chases, international airlines are seeking to reclaim 32 million now useless paper tickets so they can be securely destroyed because they're no longer using paper tickets anymore. Is there a security issue with this? Like, I've travelled locally here in Australia on one of our carriers, and you don't have to produce any ID these days. You can buy a ticket online, print it on your home printer, and you go and scan it and get your
boarding
pass.
Yeah, you even check in online, don't you?
Yeah. So what's to say that I'm not who I say I am and I get on board? That's, I don't know. How does that work?
What identification do you have to produce to actually get on the airplane now?
Nothing. None. Yeah, you online, print your boarding ticket and you walk through.
Online boarding pass, yeah.
Is that good? I don't think so.
Usability versus security. It's what it always comes
down
to.
Right. It's exactly the same, yeah.
So, I don't know. Is the paper ticket sort of scenario on international flights in particular? Like, I don't know whether you could print your own boarding ticket on an international flight like you can on a domestic flight, but seriously, that's got to be a bit of an issue, I would have thought, all around. What do you reckon?
I'm going to be doing some international flying in the next
few months,
so yeah. I'll let you know how
do
we
some
go.
Research for us.
I will. All in the name of teaching.
You're going to have a moment, then.
Yeah.
You're doing some assignment work for us, I believe.
You're going to file some reports from international locations?
I'm going to try and smuggle my mini-disc recorder and a microphone into the plane with me. We'll see how far I get. I might get booted off. May not do any travelling at all.
Just make sure your microphone hasn't got a sharp edge on it.
Indeed. That's the key.
Local Vodafone customer base hits 4 million. That's not bad for a little telco, is it? That's about nearly just under a quarter of the population.
I think that qualifies as not a little telco
not
anymore.
Not that little. Yeah, never was, really, internationally.
Well, they've got the iPhone coming, haven't they, Vodafone?
Apparently so.
Along with everybody else.
Along with everybody else. And you get them down the local 7-Eleven on the corner, too, fairly shortly. But mobile phone operator Vodafone says it's well-placed and prepared for its 2008 fiscal year after bolstering its customer base by 9.6%. They've done very well. Vodafone's customer base, an increase more than 4 million in the 12 months. That's not bad. Increase to more than 4 million in the 12 months ending March 31, up from 3.675 million in the previous year. So they put on 400,000 users in 12 months. So maybe we've been speculating about the wrong things, really. Maybe the mobile phone market's got plenty to go. I wonder what their mobile broadband offering's like. Any ideas?
I don't use anything from Vodafone.
Okay.
I don't use any voice services. I don't use any data services, but send us an email if you do.
My wife uses Vodafone Voice. Very happy with it.
How does she find that in terms of the coverage? And
well, she's a city dweller, pretty much, so it works pretty well for her.
And competitive plans?
Yeah, probably the cheapest plans you could find, actually.
Oh, good. Must admit, I don't know many Vodafone users. I don't know why. Maybe, I don't know.
Let's get a little bit technical. Is she on GSM or 3G?
No, GSM. And she's using a Sagem French phone, which is quite fond of.
Sagem, you don't hear much about them, do you?
No.
They make shortwave receivers and things like that, don't
they?
Yeah. Very interesting.
Tassie. You remember the Tassie broadband dilemmas?
Yes.
Well, guess who's put their $5 million on the table? The government
The government.
Good on them. Yeah, the Tassie state government popped $5 million on the table, which was required as part of the bond to take the take part in the federal government's $4.7 billion national broadband project. That's amazing. So we've now got a government competing with telcos to roll out the...
But was that for the network within the state, or was this for the cross Bass Strait link?
It's just that they've put $5 million on the table. Though Senator Conroy this week declined to divulge the identities of other parties who've also paid the $5 million bond, it's known that the Tasmanian government will join 6 other companies. So they're going for the full whack. They're going for the full whack. Those parties to have confirmed their participation include Telstra and Terrier, which is G9, Optus and Transact, which is the ACT stuff. They've got good stuff in Canberra. I don't know why they don't need broadband to the node. They've got fibre to the node up there, haven't they, in Canberra? They're blindingly fast. Both Macquarie Bank and Canadian-based Axia Group are also believed to have lodged the bond, but are yet to publicly confirm their involvement. Parties that lodge the $5 million bond before Friday, May the 23rd, will gain access, they win the door prize, will gain access to the secret telco network information structure.
Fantastic.
Isn't that great?
And I see that that Western Australia actually had their own state broadband plans as well, which are in a bit of disarray now.
Have they?
As a result of the national plan. That's about as far as I know, to be honest.
Very good. All right. Everyone's getting in on the act. I wonder how long Senator Conroy is going to keep the said opportunity open. They've extended it and extended it again, so we'll wait and see what happens. All right, you're listening to Tech Talk Radio, Oddspot Gadget and Website of the Week, coming up after this.
You're listening.
Dr. Ron?
Here I am
Residual power. And I've got some residual
power. You can't turn off CDMA.
In terms of the volume,
over a second, your fingerprints. Now, this
we may have digressed.
Talk radio.
Phil Burgess also claimed the country would remain behind.
We used to think 600
kilometres. Don't open things that are as good as you're not expecting, even if they do it for you.
Well, this time, to Tech Talk Radio.
Recently on Tech Talk Radio, we heard Ben-Hur Castro from Seagate in the United States talk about the new generation of portable hard drives, which not only backs up your files with the push of a button, it also password protects the contents of your drive. Not only does the MaxStore OneTouch 4 Plus provide backups, data storage and protection for your files, it also protects your entire computer system in case of disaster. Now for the good news. Thanks to MaxStore, Tech Talk Radio has a 1TB version of the OneTouch to give away to a lucky Tech Talk Radio listener. Anywhere in the world, valued at $299. All you have to do is visit the Tech Talk Radio website and tell us in a few short words why you need 1TB of storage. How easy is that? We'll announce the winner on air on Monday the 16th of June. So what are you waiting for? Visit techtalkradio.com.au right now and you could be the proud owner of a 1TB OneTouch portable hard drive.
In this house, we obey the laws of thermodynamics!
Tech Talk Radio's Gadget of the Week.
What do you think of when you think of Garmin?
GPS systems.
Garmin earlier this year announced the impending release of the Nuva phone.
A what? What's a Nuva phone when it's at home?
This is a fully featured Garmin GPS.
It's a phone, is it?
An HSDPA and GSM quad band telephone, which features a web browser, email, Wi-Fi connectivity, Bluetooth connectivity, a 3.5-inch display, and it runs Garmin's proprietary operating system.
Whoa.
It's multimedia friendly with MP3, ACC, and MP4 support, and has a built-in camera camcorder.
So you can record yourself driving down the train tracks.
You can.
And driving off the
cliff. When it gives you information to turn left at the next
very good
traffic light.
And listen to some nice music while you do it.
That's right.
Yes. Very good.
No suicide is painless or something like that.
Does it have GPP, genuine people personality?
I'm sure it does, because Garmin do GPSs very, very well.
They do.
So it'll be interesting to see how well they go with the telephone side
of it. I had a Garmin, it broke.
Oh, but did it work well when it...
Yeah, it was good when it worked.
Right up until the point where it broke.
That's right.
No pricing or carrier announcement has been made yet.
Hey, it'll be interesting to see what Telstra think of it, because you know what they told Apple about their iPhone? Go back and keep the knitting. So it'll be interesting to see
what Telstra say to Garmin.
Really, did they say that?
I did.
Steve Jobs wouldn't have been happy about that.
Notice Telstra hasn't announced that they're using the iPhone yet. So anyway, go on.
Indeed. So keep your eyes and ears open, www.garmin.com, for the Garmin Nuva phone.
Here it is, everybody. The world's greatest website.
Tech Talk Radio website of the week.
This is a contentious little website, which I quite like.
Zoho?
Zoho was contentious. Zoho was tremendous, yeah. This week's one is bugmenot.com. Bugmenot.com was created as a mechanism to quickly bypass the login of websites that require compulsory registration and or the collection of personal or demographic information. For example, the New York Times.
Yep.
Oh, I've heard about these. Simply enter the domain name into the search box and the chances are you'll have a full page of login details returned to you.
So I
sounds a bit chonky.
Well, it does sound a bit chonky, doesn't it? But it works very well. There was Graham's typing in Tech Talk Radio. I didn't try that one. The one I did try that I'm always I have to register every time I go to it because I forget what my user name and password is Driver Guide. We can get all the great drivers for various devices. So I typed in Driver Guide.
It's a generic one.
And I wasn't disappointed. It returned hundreds and hundreds of login details. The site currently has login details for nearly 194,000 websites. If webmasters are concerned that their site has login details listed in Bug Me Not, they don't want them listed there.
Like I was just, yes.
They can report their site, and any account details will be removed, and the site in question will be blocked from future submissions.
Oh, very good.
Bug Me Not also provides free, anonymous, disposable email addresses.
Ah, like good old Mailinator.
Like good old Mailinator. So this might be useful to you.
I like Mailinator.
The website, Tech Talk Radio website of the week, bugmenot.com.
There is a fine line between genius and madness.
Shoot. Missed it by that much.
I know nothing. Nothing.
Houston, we have a problem.
The Odd Spot on Tech Talk Radio.
Somewhat topical given our discussions of eBay during the show. German police are investigating a couple after they allegedly offered their 8-month-old son for sale on eBay.
Yeah.
Renee Beck, a police spokesman in the Bavarian town of Krumbach, west of Munich, said on Saturday the 23-year-old woman told them it was only a joke. But he said police were nevertheless continuing their investigation and the baby had been put in state custody. The police spokesman says that she said it was a joke. That's not yet clear. Detectives are investigating on suspicion of child trafficking. Mm. A number of people called authorities across Germany after seeing the offer on eBay that read, "A baby, collection only. Offer my nearly new baby for sale because it cries too much. Male, 70 centimetres long." The opening bid was €1. There were no bidders during the 2 hours the auction was running before the offer was removed.
Because it cries too much.
Said police.
No buy it now?
No buy it now. No. The mother was quoted as saying, "It was only a joke. I just wanted to see if someone would make an offer. They've taken my son to hospital, and now they want me to take psychiatric tests next week."
That's probably a reasonable outcome.
Yep. Oh, there you go. That's the odd spot of the week on TikTok Radio.
An odd spot.
Only out of Europe, I suspect, things like that. Well, that could have happened in the United States, I guess. Anyway. All right.
Sadly, it could have happened anywhere.
You have been listening to Dr. Ron with the odd spot of the week there. Graham Callaghan, Justin Dunlop's in, and we've got a visitor in the corner who's been very quiet throughout the course of the evening. He's wearing a Tech Talk Radio cap, which I think is great, and I want one after the show.
Where did you get it from?
Hey, just pick him up. You've been to China, have you?
Pick him up online.
Yeah, good. All right, until the same time next week, it's been fantastic. It's been a fun show tonight, and we'll do it all again next week on Tech Talk Radio in your ears. Bye for now.
You've been listening to Tech Talk Radio, brought to you each and every week by a group of dedicated professionals from within the media, broadcasting, IT and telecommunications industries. The team consists of executive producer Andrew McComb, producer Dr. Ron Panlis, Graham Callaghan and Mark Diggins, expert opinion Adam Turner, and our US correspondent is Lydia Davis. Post-production facilities courtesy of Evolving Communications. Podcast production by Graham Callaghan. Tech Talk Radio is broadcast, recorded and streamed live to the world each and every Monday night at 8 p.m. from the studios of 3WBC. The crew wish to thank all the stations that take the show, including 3WBC and 3XX in Melbourne, Cairns FM, Switch 1197 in Brisbane, 95.3 Huon FM in Tasmania, Queer FM in WA, and Stop and Go Radio in the United States. For sponsorship and advertising, call 03 9018 9043 or visit our website, techtalkradio.com.au. This has been a production of Tech Talk Radio Vic and is subject to copyright and applicable laws and may not be rebroadcast without approval.